is one. Secondly, it must set out the details of the vote to be cast in respect of each decision on the agenda. There is no blanket proxy allowed. So whoever is not attending the meeting can't simply sit back and then he will not have a vote, period. So a proxy is already a very difficult aspect, and a person will have to apply his mind before giving a proxy. But I think the problem that is pointed out does not so much have to do with proxy. I think the problem is more what to do if a member continues to do not attend a meeting. I think that's more what the problem is. But we have a provision in the in section 14 of the Principal Act indicating what the constitution of a cooperative must include. And there are two things that I think that are relevant. The one is requirements for membership. And I think requirements for membership should indicate that you must attend meetings. But you don't attend meetings. How do we know what your problems, your needs, your contributions, etc. are? Secondly, there's a provision for the conditions of growth process of suspension of membership. So if someone does not attend. Because what I'm just worried about is that if we put it in legislation that where a member does not attend for 3 meetings in a row without a proper excuse, it starts becoming a must, and a cooperative no longer has any control of how many meetings. And I think it's a difficult thing to legislate for, because you might find someone being seriously ill in an hospital, and everyone in the cop is fine with this person not attending. They know what's going on. He's in a coma. He can't do anything. And we definitely, the cop, want to support his family, because this is exactly what the cop is for. Now he misses 3 meetings because he's in a coma, and suddenly legislation sort of indicates we must do something about this. I mean, yes, we will provide for the coma. I'm now sort of giving the extreme example. You know, we can't cater for everything in legislation, but I do think it is provided for in the constitution of the co-op, and I think maybe there comes training. That is where I must play a role and tell co-ops, you need to make sure that your members attend, because otherwise your co-op is not complying with the cooperative principle. So we can put something in, but I think we have to be very careful how we word so that we don't restrict. But like I said, I think it's already covered.
Members, I really want to go back to what I said originally. This is a democratic structure, highly democratic. The constitution can cover that. And my own experience is once it's in legislation, your leeway is cut. You know, so on the one hand, I'd be the first to say we don't want someone sending a box seat on and on and on. On the other, do you suspend someone because they're away from a meeting for a year? What? That's the problem. And you don't want to if they contribute. You want to have not this legislation telling you, but your own constitution and your democratic proceedings. So I want to move. I'll give you a final comment, but I suggest we move. Thank you, Arnold Mabasa.
No, I'm persuaded by the explanation Advocate Fanenarve, and I suggest we take it the way she has explained this.
Thank you very much. I'm glad we had that engagement. Whoa, is this a different point, Chief Director?
It's the same point, but on a slightly tech. What I would rather suggest, because it's already a decision we made, we just have a clause that says that a cooperative must stipulate a limitation on the usage of, in this constitution, on the usage of a proxy by each member. So that they know that it cannot be used recurrently, you see, and abused. You just leave it to them to do it. So in a way, the lawmaker is signaling that this thing must be disciplined. All right? Yes. Thanks.
I'm asking you a question, our Chief Director. Can't you put that in secondary legislation?
I can, if that is what the House gives me the right. I will do that then.
Right. Page 39. Page 38. We did use 26. It was 27 now. Right. 27, and simply the heading there. Management governance of cooperatives. No problems with that. Amendment of Section 32 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 28, A, 3, B, page 44, 5, 6. I see we don't have problems, no objections. Right. Substitution of Section 38 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 29, the bottom of page 40. Certain circumstances, this reward, etc., remuneration, page 41, 38, 1, 2, 3. Right, we're moving. I don't see hands, and you know, you've all studied this at length. I've made no notes there, page 42. Amendment of Section 39 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 30. Resignation, removals, etc. Do you remember how we went into this? Right. I see we can move. No objections. Page 42. Amendment of Section 41 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 31. 3. 4. 5. Right, I don't see any objections here. Let's see, we can move. Amendment of Section 44, Act 14, 2005, Clause 32. A. Page 43, 3. B. 5. The surplus issue, we went into detail, came to an agreement. A, B, C. Right, I don't see any objections. See, we can move. Page 43, substitution of Section 46 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 33. Reserves. Remember the whole issue of reserves, right? Fresh start, agreed to. Clause 36, 46, 1. Page 44, 2. 3. 4. A, B, C. I see we're all on board. No objections. Substitution of heading to Chapter 7 of Act 14, 2005. A substitution of a heading. And so it's audited reports, etc. And independent renewed reports, of course. Page 45. But before we get there, that's agreed to. It was a heading. No objections. Page 45. Substitution of Section 47 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 35. The auditor's report. 47.1, A, B, C. 2, 3, 4. Up to the end of page 45, and that's Clause 35. I see no objections. We can move. Page 46, substitution of Section 48 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 36. 48, 1, 2, 3, A, B, 4, page 47, 5, 6, A, B, 7, A. Page 48, B, C. So that was then our clause, which went on and on, Clause 36. I see no objections being raised. We can move then and remain on page 48. Clause 37, which is the substitution of Section 49, Act 14, 2005. The auditor and independent reviewer disqualified from acting 14.1. A. Roman 1, 2. Page 49. Roman 3. B. 2. Right. I see no objections being raised. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I'm a full member of this committee, but I am working on the details of this bill, but I did keep an eye on what was coming through, and there was very good stuff through from the accountants and the reviewers and various financial people. I'm just accepting, as we're clearing myself, I'm accepting that with all these tremendous brain boxes, which are mostly sitting opposite me, and also all the evidence we've had,
we all this technical stuff is covered, and terms like independent review and audit and so on, we've got all that kind of organized. But I just want to make, I'm just passing on this because I'm actually ignorant and I don't want to make a fool of myself.
Well, I would hope you are applying your mind, Honourable McIntosh, because we don't want the court coming here today. Now, Honourable McIntosh stated publicly he wasn't applying his mind because he had the ignorance thereof. You are, I take it, applying your mind, having heard the evidence and the information. Of course, we hope we, and we know we're not being misled. So we've applied our minds, having sought the expertise. But I know where you're coming from. You're not an auditor. Yes, Honourable Maggie Mabasa.
Secondly, Honourable McIntosh has already significantly, enormously influenced the policy of the bill. So he will continue that way.
Exactly. And we're looking forward to that. And a little light comment here, and let's keep us going. Page 48. Clause 37. That was the substitution of Section 49 Act 14, 2005. Right. Auditor, etc. In fact, we had that, and then we went backwards, didn't we? 49, 1A, Roman 1, 2, 3, page 49, B, 2. Right, that was clause 37, no objections. Right, we move, thank you. Amendment to Section 50, Act 14, 2005, clause 38, A, B, C, page 50, D, E, F, G, page 51, 6, no objections on that. We did do a lot of work there at one point. We'll get explanations and we've agreed. No objections. We move. Page 51, amendment of section 51 at 14, 2005, clause 39, A. 52, B, C, D. So that takes care of clause 39, page 51 and 2. And no objections, we move. Amendment of Section 52, Act 14, Clause 40, A, B, C, D, E. Clause 40, I see no objections, we move. Amendment of Section 53, Act 14, 2005, Clause 41, A, 1, 2, B, 3, 4, page 55, 5, 6, A, B. That then was clause 41, no objections, I see, let's move. Amendment of section 54, Act 14, 2005, clause 42, 1, page 56, 2, 3. That was clause 42. No objections. We move. Page 56. Clause 43. Repeal of section 55 of Act 14 of 2005. Amendment of section 56 of Act 14, 2005. Well, actually, the one was just the repeal. Do you follow that? Simply the repeal here of that. And we agree. I see no objection to that. Amendment of Section 56 of Act 14 of 2005, Clause 44. C. Right, no objections, I see. Amendment of Section 60 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 45, 4. I see no objections, we move. Amendment of Section 62 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 46, Page 55, Roman 1, 2, 3. B. C. D. E. Page 59. E. C. Roman 1, 2. Right. We also did a lot of work in that area, explanations and so on, advice. I see no objections now. We can move. Amendment of Section 63, Act 14, 2005, Clause 47. Right, 6. No objections. I see we can move. The bottom of the page. Amendment of Section 64 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 48A. Over the page, 60B. Right, Honourable Vandermeer.
The third, la fourth line, 60. It is an offence for any director to make a false declaration. Don't we have to put there in terms of what, what offence? Like we did in the previous thing, we don't need to.
It will then be the statutory offence of contravening that particular section, and then the general offences section tells what the penalty for it is.
Thank you very much. I see the DEG is here. Very welcome. Page 60, Amendment of Section 66 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 49A. B. Right, I see no objections. Right, and I can see everyone is alert here. You've made your notes. Page 61, we move. Amendment of Section 67, Act 14, 2005, Clause 50. A. B. C. Right. No objections. We move. Amendment of Section 68, Act 14, 2005, Clause 51 at the bottom of the page. Page 62, A, B. Right, I see no objections. No objections, I take it. Right, it's a conferring. We move. Amendment of Section 69 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 52. One. And we move to page 63. But of course there we've already ended that, clause 52. There was just the one. We seem to be on board. No objections. We move. Page 63. Insertion of section 78 of Act 14 of 2005, clause 53. The following subsection rather is hereby inserted in the principal act after 70. Fees for amalgamation, division, conversion, or transfer. 70A, 1, 2. A, B, C, D. Substitution of Section 71 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 54. Modes of winding up, very important. Modes of winding up. 71, 1, A, B, C. 2. No objections, and we've really tackled that effectively. Page 64, insertion of Section 71A in Act 14, 2005, Clause 55. Voluntary winding up. 71A. We all seem on board there. No objections. Amendment of Section 72 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 56. Right. Honourable McIntosh?
I'm ignorant. A special resolution, I mean, I just want to check, and I'm sure it's done and covered, to have a special resolution related to wind it up voluntarily may need to be a kind of special resolution. And I just wondered what the provisions are for special resolutions.
Clarification on the special resolution. Are you responding to that, Advocate Vandermeer? Or Ms. Idenson?
the term special resolution is already defined in the Principal Act as requiring a special majority vote of at least two-thirds the members present, or such greater majority as may be specified in the Constitution. So the Constitution has the greater upper for important things like winding up if it wants.
Very much. I think everyone's happy there, no objections. The bottom of page 64, amendment of Section 72, Act 14, 2005, Clause 56. Right, we're all on board, no objections. Page 65, insertion of Section 72A, 72B in Act 14, 2005, Clause 57. Application for declaratory order, 72A. Registrar, etc. The winding up our order of tribunal, 72B. Oh, yes, Honourable Hill Lewis.
I've just lost my... Thank you. It just seems strange that the carpenter can commit a crime once, and that's all right, but if it does it twice, then that's a problem. Sorry, the first one. The first one. 6572BA. The cooperative has more than once been convicted of an offence in terms of Section 94. It seems strange that it can commit an offence once, and that's all right, but it can't do it twice.
Yeah, well, look, let's just turn to Ms. Idelson on that one.
Yes, that's the intention. Once can be all right, simply because winding up is such an incredibly radical event, which would affect the existence of the cooperative, all of its members, their dependents, creditors, and so on. And some of the offences are what we might call technical offences. They don't involve fraud or malicious intent or anything. It's failure to comply with some regulatory requirement. So sometimes it is okay to have a little leeway and say, look, it wasn't a fence, once is enough, it's a technical thing, but sort yourselves out.
Right. Honourable Hillers.
You see, the 72B before A says that, it's up to the discretion of the tribunal, since the tribunal may. So if the offence is so severe in the first instance, that the tribunal may well feel that winding up is necessary. So why can't we just leave it at their discretion?
I suppose the whole thing was looking at this whole culture of the co-op, and who we're dealing with. Where do we want the sword of Damocles? When do we want it to fall? I mean, we're obviously all very concerned with the requirements here, and we want to do things properly. But I can hear where experts are coming from. Let's just hear Honourable McIntosh coming from the farms. He may have another approach.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Simple farmers often have more common sense than brains. But anyway, I think the critical thing, and I take Honourable Hill Lewis's point, is Section 19.4. If Section 19.4 is sort of technical issues, then I think there's a case for shall we say, a slap on the wrist or quick forgiveness. But if it is a co-op which, for example, is involved in illegal diamond mining, and so on, now that would be covered presumably by the common law. But I just think one needs some help there. But I think Hilda is making an important point. Thank you.
Thank you. If you turn to page 33, you will see that section 19.4 is one of the sections we are changing. And it lists a specific kind of offence, which is, as I said earlier, a rather technical kind of an offence. It is the offence of not cooperating with an inspector, not providing information, documents, etc. It's not the kind of drug smuggling, child sex slave kind of terrible stuff. And sometimes I think in these circumstances, given that the law is not always readily accessible and understandable, a slap on the wrist is sometimes appropriate rather than the radical elimination of an entire operative.
Take you first, Chief Director Ndumo.
Yes, Chairperson, I think this section only deals with issues that pertain to this Act, not in terms of criminality, which will be covered under the Criminal Act broadly. That one is not implied. It only deals with, if you look at Section 2, must not pursue any object to perform any act that is not authorized by the Constitution. Subject to subsection 1 and 2, a corporate must not record all business transactions completed with members and non-members. So it must do all of these things. So we're saying that they can make a mistake once or an offense once on these areas, but twice then they could subject it to dissolution. It's more like just making it ease, you know, for them. Even though we're saying it will be on the basis of tribunal, which will take the discretion, but the tribunal was saying don't be harsh as well, because we can guide the tribunal. I'd like to believe the lawmaker can say that.
I think it's a clear understanding it does not involve criminal activity or anything bordering that. There's this little technicality, and it's already got to have shown you prepared to cooperate. It's just you missed it off. We happy with that. Yeah, positive approach to the whole matter, yes. That was page 65. 72A and 72B, A, B, C. Right, page 666, D, E. And there we are, we seem happy now, all of us, no objections now. The repeal then of section 73, 74, 75, 76 of 8 Act 14, 2005. Clause 38 comes in there. And we have the substitution of section 77 of Act 14, as a fine. We all have objections on that? Right. And I know that all of you have studied the Principal Act, and it's right next to you there. Okay, so easy reference. Clause 59, which was the substitution then of section 77 of Act 14, really is judicial management. 77, page 67, 2 and 3. Again, no objections. We move substitution of section 81 of Act 14, 2005, clause 60. Yes, I see. Honourable Abasa.
Possibly just a typo. On page 67, 60, after the act, submission of document A. Oh, no. Now I realize I read it wrong. No, let's proceed to my apologies.
The same thing on my computer. It seems to have too many T's. But, no, that one's fine, eh? Substitution of section 81A, 14, 2005, clause 60. Submission of documentation to registrar, no problem. I see no objections now. And 81. Right. And then we move to Amendment of 8, Section 82, Act 14, 2005, Clause 61. We go across to page 68, A, B. I see no challenges, no objections, so we move. Substitution of Section 84, Act 14, 2005, Clause 62. Investigation by Registrar, 84, 1A, Roman 1, 2, 3. I just noticed that law advisor, as a matter of fact, I see a couple of the ors in here, which sort of heartened me that we don't have any real objection to or, the bottom of the page. I just thought I'd mention that. Okay, thank you very much. So they seem to be okay there. Page 69, B, A, B, 2, A, B, Roman 1, 2, 3, 4, 3. Page 70, no, we remain here. Page 69, no objections, we move. Page 70. amendment of Chapter 12, Act 14, 2005, Clause 63. Right. No objections. We move. Amendment of Section 86 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 64. A. B. 1. Well, D, 1, Roman 1 and 2. C. Page 71. Don't see any objections, so we move to amendment of Section 87, Act 14, 2005, Clause 65. A. B. I see no objections. We move. Insertion of Chapters 12A, 12B, 12C. In Act 14, 2005, the insertion then, Clause 66. Right, and we now begin to see this insertion. Okay. Chapter 12A, Cooperative Development Agency, Part 1. Page 72.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Just on a point of information and congratulation, you have now gone exactly halfway through this 143-page document.
I'm happy to say that was a real encouragement. Honourable Mabasa.
Sorry to take this lady back on the chair. On page 70, page 64, on Roman 2, where it says promote equity and greater participation. So it's up to, I think we should remove that so that it's cooperatives of the plural, not of
case, yes. Yeah. Well done. You know, I never spot these. And that is important. Thank you. We agree. Yeah, we move. Thank you, Honourable Professor. Page 71. But we already, I think, done that in a way, haven't we? And we are then the halfway mark. Yes. Halfway mark, page 72. Establishment of the Cooperative Development Agency, 91A, 1, 2, 3. Objectives of the agency, 91B, A, B, page 73, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, page 74, L. Right, everyone happy so far? No objections, 91A and B, no objections. We moved then to functions of the agency on page 74, 91C, 1A, Roman, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6B. Roman 1, 2, 3, page 75, 4, C. Roman 1, 2, 3, D. Roman 1, 2, 3, 4, page 76. Roman 5, E. Roman 1, 2, 3, 4. F. Roman 1, 2, 3, 4. Page 77. G. H. I. J. Well, no, I. 2. The agency must. A, B, C, D. Right, that was 91C. No objections. We move to 91D, functions of the agency in respect of satellite agencies of the agency. Right, page 78. A, Honourable Mabasa.
Oh, just page 77. On functions of the agency, don't we need to write it the way you read it? You said offices of the agency, so don't we need that there?
Yes, the manner in which I read it, functions of agency, of the agency, is that what you're saying? Do we not say the agency? The, T-H-E. Yes, thank you. I kind of automatically... yes. just showed how the auto takes over. Right, 91D, page 78ABC, no objections, general powers of agency. You know, yeah, you see, it's based the way we see it, the agency. We're to make it clearer to some of us who are still in the remedial section like myself. General powers of the agency, 91E. A, B, C, D, E, page 79, Roman 1, 2. Right. No objections, remove reporting agency, 91F, 1, 2, A, B. We move. No objections, we are moving, page 80, part 2, funding and financial management of... I think let's just put the agency in everywhere. The. So that you just do that little find and replace, funding of the agency. 91G. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Agency is funded by A, B, C, D. No objections, I think we move. Page 81. Annual budget and strategic plan, 91H. I don't see a problem, no objections, we move. Financial management, financial statements and annual report, 91I. No problem, no objections, we move. Part 3. National government oversight and executive authority. Executive authority. 91J, 1, 2, 3. A, B. Page 82, C, D. No objections, I see. We move. Information, 91K. No objections, we move. Chapter 12B, Cooperative Tribunal. Establishment, legal status, and composition of a cooperative tribunal, 91L1. A, B, C, page 83G. No objections. We move appointment and composition of the tribunal, 91M1. A, B, C, D, E, F, E, D, 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 84B. F, G, 3, membership, A, B, C, D, E. We went over this at length. 4, page 85, top of 85, 5, 6, A, B, 7, A, 7, 7, B, A, B, C. You remember we added that in all members under C at the bottom, 8, page 86, right, A.
Madam Chair.
Honourable Mackinson.
Madam Chair, I notice again we have this removal of the article. Of the definite article, the. So it's not functions of that tribunal in heading, it's just functions of the tribunal. I don't look, I think the drafters must give us some advice, but my understanding is in legal terms, these little paragraph headings are not legally binding. So, and I think that's partly why they talk about functions of tribunal, functions of or the agency. But in the actual content of each clause, it's the tribunal and the agency. But, Madam Chair, I also have some of those old English grammar backgrounds, so I'd be a bit more comfortable seeing that. But I think technically, in swallowing the consistency, I'm not sure that it's appropriate in the, in, as it were, the description of the contents of the clause.
I mean, I look at state law advisor, I hear what has been said. So in the content itself, let's put the book in, which we're looking here and there. But in the heading, we'll then move to what could be called 21st century modern English, is that it? Page 86. Functions of tribunal, 91N, A, B, C, D. By the way, I should just say that in 90, the first one, which went on for so long then, 91M, there were no objections, we moved. And then on 86, 91N, A, B, C, D, page 87, F, G, H, I, J, K. Right, I see no objections, we move prohibition on tribunal, bottom of page 87, 91O, A, page 88B. Right, no objections, we move appointment and composition, investigators, inspectors, or inspectorate, 91P, 1, AB, 2, ABC, Roman 1, Roman 2, no objections, we move. 91Q, the tribunal, the adjudication of hearings before the tribunal. A, B, 2, A, B, C, 3, page 90, right. Page, at the end of page 89, no objections, 91Q, we move to page 90, right to participate in hearing. 91R, agency A, B, C, D. No objections, 91R, we move. Powers of tribunal in adjudicating hearing, 91S, A, B, C. Roman 1, 2, 3 on page 91. No objections, we move. Rules of procedure, 91T, no objections, we move. Witnesses, 91U. No objections, we move. Witnesses, 91U. Did I say that? Yes. Appointment and composition and functions of Cooperative Conflict Resolution Commission. Very important commission, that conflict resolution. 91UV. 1. 92, 2, 3, 4. No objections, we move to the right of information. 91W, 1, 2. No objections, we move to summons. Page 93, 91X, 1, A, B, 2, A, B, 3, A. 94, page 94B, 4. A, B, 5. No objections then, so we move. 90, authority to enter and search under warrant. 91Y, 1. A, B, 2. A, B, 3. A, B, C, D, 4. Page 96. 5, 6, A, Roman 1, 2, B. Right, no objections, we move 91Z. Powers to enter research, A, 1, A and B. Page 97, C, not D, E, F, G. Roman 1, 2, 3, H. 2, A, page 98, B, and then 3. That was of no objections there for 91Z. We move. Conduct of entry and search. Very important conduct, I think. 91AA, double A. 1, 2, 3. A, B, 4. A. Page 99B, 5, 6, 7. I see no objections, we move. 91BB, 1, 2, page 100, A, B, 3A, Roman,
I had a note scribbled in the margin on page 95 too, which I missed, I'm sorry. In page 95A, the third A that appears on the page. the contravention of this act has taken place, I wonder if Advocate Eisenstein could just advise that this is normal, or Advocate van der Merwe, because should it not be a contravention of this act has likely taken place? It's difficult to prove that it has taken place.
Thank you. Yes. You need to read the reading paragraph before it. If there are reasonable grounds to believe that.
It just shows that we did apply our minds and study the document, which is good. 100 then. I think we were on page 100, were we not? A. B. 3. A. Roman 1, 2, 3, 4. B. Page 101. Roman 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. C. Roman 1, 2, 3. Double A. Page 102. Double B. And then 4. A. B. 5. A. B. 6. 7. A. B. Roman 1, 2. 8. A. B. C. No objections now, we move to, still on page 103, assertion of chapter 12C, in Act 14, 2005, clause 67, intergovernmental relations. Very important for this one, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I just raise this as a question, because intergovernmental, I mean, I know what it means, but it could also be across the borders. And what I would just like to ask is whether there is a provision for the fact that co-ops may want to, for example, operate in different SADC countries in addition to here. As an example, AFGRI, which is part of the agricultural setup, for example, and it's a trading arm of a co-op, but it's gone corporate. But it was, they have they've opened offices in DRC to support the South Africans who are extending the embalming nations, and they also opened offices in Zambia, and I understand they're also doing it in Mozambique. So I just wanted to find out, is that covered? I'm sure it is somewhere, that they can trade outside of the borders of South Africa. I mean, not that you trade, but a co-op can operate outside.
Honourable Mabasa.
No, the answer to the question is yes. That is the attitude taken by the subcommittee, but actually it's international in character. So the only thing I can do is to point where we addressed it.
Check with our advocates. I'll take Vandermeer on Advocate Vandermeer first, followed by Ms. Ironson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think that we specifically say that state that they're allowed to trade internationally, just like you don't do that with a company or with a company. It is allowed. This specific chapter does not deal so much with trading as what it deals with cooperation within our own government. So it is almost like a formality type of chapter. Cooperatives actually don't really need to read this even. It doesn't really apply to them. It's how government deals with cooperatives.
Ms. Ironson?
To add to what Fanova said, trade internationally is not just not prohibited, it's allowed, but it's also encouraged, because one of our cooperative principles is to develop international links and regional links and so on. And remember, we've got the National Apex Cooperative. Part of its mandate will be to forge international trade links and so on. So there are various places throughout the legislation where it's in fact actively encouraged where appropriate.
Are we all at one? Let's co-op. Chief Director Normal.
Thank you, Dan. That is that this law took it for granted that all forms of business are I love to do trades. Similarly with the cooperative, there is nothing in this law that stipulates the issues about trade and all that kind of stuff. But what it does in some clauses talk to the relationship where cooperatives enter into as apex bodies, as tertiary cooperatives and all of that. And there is also a principle of cooperative cooperating, which also not only assumes jurisdictions within the South African juristic borders, but it also assumes that that cooperative principle can be expressed internationally.
We're all at one on this one now with that explanation. So we then move to page 104, applicability of intergovernmental relations, framework policies and legislation. 91cc, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K. Okay, right. We're all at one, I think. No objections were raised. Page 105, intergovernmental structures, 91DD, 1, AB, 2, AB, Roman 1, Roman 2, 3. Page 106, 4. No objections raised. We move functions of intergovernmental structures, 91EE, A, B, C, D, E. Page 107, F. No objections. We move administrative and procedural arrangements, 91F, establishment, composition and functions of interprovincial coordination committee on cooperatives. 91, do, no objections. We move 91GG, 1, 2, A, B, Roman 1, 2, 3. Page 108, C, D, 3. 4, 5, 6, 7. Right, it seems as if we're all at one. No objections, we move 109, page 109, 91H, H, 1, 2, A. B, C, D, E, F. Right, all, no objections made so far. And page 110, that'll be G. No objections, we move. Still on page 110, dispute and conflict resolution 91, II. No objections, I see. We move framework for intergovernmental relations, 91JJ, 1, A, B, 111, 2. No objections. We move amendment 92 of Act 14 of 2005. Clause 68, A, 3, B, 4. Page 100, right, so that was clause 68, no objections, we move. Page 112, insertion of sections 94A, 94B, in Act 14, 2005, clause 69. Reporting, monitoring, evaluation, and assessment, 94A, A, Roman 1, 2, 3, 3, and then we go to 6, is that right? In the middle of the page, 112, 94, A, Roman 1, 2, 3, and then 6. Now we thought, we made a note of this last week. Roman 1, 2, 3, 4 on page 112 at the bottom. Okay? Yeah. Cross the floor, that one, B. Now we go to, that's it, right, no objections. We on the Chief Director, writ of co-ops, page, Honourable Van der Merwe.
Chair, do we want to put in legislation, specify a Chief Directorate? Is that not a responsibility internally of the department? It may be such that you need eventually, in a couple of years, a branch within the department under a DDG that would be necessary. Should we not say, I'm open to hear arguments, but the entity within the department responsible for cooperatives cut out the rest, must in respect of cooperatives, so that we don't specify that it's the chief directorate. I thought that was an internal matter for a department structuring an organogram, not for legislation.
This was raised before, probably by yourself. And we actually, you made the same point. I think it may have been overlooked. Looking at everyone in the team, and
we want you to be the DDG, please.
The thing is, you know, we may change even the title, Chief Director. I don't know. Miss Ndorma, you remember this came up? Yes.
It did, and it came up, Chairperson. In fact, I think what we expressed at the time was that this one, we are not really, even ourselves at the department, married to a type chief directorate. We're more married to the function, meaning that there has to be a function within the department that deals with cooperatives. It could be a division at some point. It could even at some point be more than just a division. All right, yes, thanks. So I think we could, the committee is at liberty to give us whatever that would be suitable. Thanks.
I think the proposal is already here that we actually remove this known as the chief directorate and rather just simply end, as you said, for cooperatives must, within the department responsible for cooperatives, must in respect of cooperatives, whatever that is. Honourable Vandermeer?
There will then be other amendments necessary which I haven't done. At the bottom of the page, to consequential, yeah.
There's going to be quite a few consequential amendments. And just pointing that out to everyone, and yourself as well, Mr. Hermans. Right. Page 114, Roman 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, objections, we move. But that one must be amended and fixed by the drafters. Amendment of Section 97, Act 14, 2005, to 70A, 2A, B, B. So it's A and B, but the other one is underneath. Right, page 115, 3, C, B, Berman 1, 2, 3, 2B, D, 7, A, B, 8, 9, Claude, page, right. No objections, we move to page 116. Amendment of item 2, part 1 of schedule 1 to act. Normally, haven't we said of act? I'm now confused. To act 14 of 2005, clause 71. Limited. All limited, no objections, we move. Clause 72, substitution of item 6 of part 1 of schedule 1 to act 14, 2005, exclusion, application of other legislation. Application of other legislation, no objections, we move. 6, 1, A, B, remember the housing cooperative issue? 1, we, no objections now, we move. Page 117. Amendment of item 2 of part 2 of schedule 1 at 14, 2005, clause 73. Have I not just read that? Yes, well I see it's a slightly different one applying again, have a consequential amendment. No objections, we move. Substitution of item 6 of part 2 of schedule 1 to act 14, 2005, clause 74. Application of labour legislation, very important. 1, 2, 3. Page 118, 4, 5. No objections, we move. Amendment of Part 3, Schedule 1 to Act 14 of 2005, insertion of Item 1A in Part 3 of Schedule 1 to Act 14, 2005, Clause 75. Name of cooperative. 1A. We dealt with that in detail before. Substitution of Item 6 of Part 3 of Schedule 2 Act 14, 2005. So that was 2075, no objection to that clause, 76 at the bottom of the page. We then move to 119. Yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask a question on page 118. Look, I understand the background to this clause 74, application of labour legislation. What I am concerned about is that our subcommittee, and maybe my colleague or my boss can help us here, is he satisfied that this clause will not, clause 4 and 5 will not result in a COB losing its cooperative spirit, as it were, and that the Minister of Labour will be sensitive to the culture of cooperatives? That's the question I really just got on that.
Honourable Mabasa?
I think here that was being explored where the skills and the person that will be able to respond holistically, that, you know, it will be the minister in the Department of Labour. Not in what is being expressed, but I think that was the spirit of the task chain.
I remember we had achieve a balancing act here, because we had the bogus co-ops issue, we had this, and it was a very difficult issue for us, you will recall, some of you who came in on the public hearings. How do you balance this, you know? And I thought that we had taken care of that without compromising the spirit. I'm looking at everyone as I say that. We were all present, all of us, at the time. And of course, the advocates as well. Right. Okay. Then that was... So we can move with that. No objections. Page 118. Amendments of Part 3 of Schedule 1 to Act 14, 2005. The insertion of this Part 3 of Schedule 1 to Act 14 of 2005, Clause 75, Name of Co-op. That's where we were, 1A. No problem, I see, no objection. We move Clause 76, Exemptions, page 119, 6A. We then go to substitution of item, no objections there, so we move. Substitution of item 8 of Part 3 of Schedule 1 to Act 14, 2005, Clause 77. Definitions, 8. Page 120. Substitution of rights. So I see no objections then to Clause 77. Is that Clause 77, Honourable Mabasa? No, I see no objections. We move Clause 78.
Just a question for clarity, colleague chair. On under the name there, on number 2, we say the name of an agricultural cooperative must include the word LTD, limited LTD. My question is, did we intend to illustrate, to say EG, or what? In other words, why specifically agricultural? Because I assume that LTD, the way we are expressing it, will apply across board. So that's where I need to be assisted.
Question, does it not apply to all cooperatives here? And why have we specifically identified agricultural co-ops, Mr. Dormore, Chief Director?
We set it out as a universal requirement, particularly for those cooperatives that are going to be registered under this particular act when it's promulgated. So in a sense, I don't think that is only specifically to agriculture. It's just that we inherited this from the 2005 act, which in a way was trying to address 1981 act, which allowed unlimited. So in a sense, particularly on the agricultural side of things, in a sense what we're saying that moving forward, the new ones that are coming in are going to be using limited. It's a way of protecting Mama Zongi in Lusisi so that he doesn't find himself. So I think the committee could either suggest to us that we don't put it specifically for agriculture, the limited one, and then we just leave it and assume it under the umbrella of the universal principle that is already set in the bill itself. Thank you, Chair.
I think, yes, are we not saying that all cooperatives must comply? All cooperatives, not specifically agricultural ones. I think that's... So the question perhaps
to those who crafted this advocate Mandamava. Can you come in here?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, actually what we're doing is we are saying you must comply with Section 10 and then we repeat Section 10. So I would actually advise that you perhaps remove that whole subsection, but I would then also propose that we do it in clauses, I think 71 repeats, where we also have you must comply with Section 10 and then we have the limited, and 73. Does the same. So I think we must remove it in all of those instances, and I'm not sure that I'm getting all of them, but I think where we are dealing in these schedules with the name of a cooperative, we maybe need to just go through them. If we have Section 10 there, we already have limited. So maybe just remove this limited.
Well then I'm going to advise you to please scrutinize this legislation carefully to ensure that you're not overlooking anything in this regard, because you know, we're actually at the end now asking to be princes. And we're going to rely on you as well, Mr. Hermans. Please. It's going to the princes now. That's if we agree. Right, Mr. Ndormal.
I just want to put you at rest, the chair. There is nothing here that the department were looking at that to make sure that nothing is lost, because it will make it very impossible to implement this thing if there are things that are lost. So I assure you, we've captured this thing in the clause before, and it's covered, and it's covered all cooperatives. That's it.
I want to be sure, are you proposing, I advocate yourself, Chief Director, that we remove this on the name that's covered?
We
want to get this clear.
We agree, Chief.
Now, members, you need to agree. And that's got to be consequential with the numbering, etc., etc. Right. So, we did object, but we can carry on. Addition of page 5 to Schedule 1 of Act 14, 2005, Clause 79. Part 5, the social co-ops. Application of this part 1A, B. Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis?
Just a question of clarity for the drafters. Where A and B contradict each other in some clauses, do we not need to say something about that?
A and B.
The clauses referred to in 1A and B, you know, the parts of the Act referred to. So, for example, I'll just give you an example. The clause in Part 5 on service contradicts the clauses earlier in the Act on service. This allows for 100% indivisible reserve, the other does not. So should we not set that out, that this part applies?
Call that myself, Chief Director.
That's where now we come in. That's where the difference is made in Chairperson. With social cooperatives, that application of this part, one, the name, it applies to what we've already agreed. But the requirement of the Constitution now takes a different spin, because it deals with the surplus. And one of the requirements of the surplus within the social cooperative, which is different from an enterprise cooperative, is that all its surplus is kept. There is nothing that goes for distribution to members, because that is serving a particular good. That good which it has to do. So there is no distribution there.
I'm not asking for clarity on the surface. I'm saying in 1B, we're saying that it must comply with other relevant provisions of this Act. But the other relevant provisions of the Act say that a maximum of 5% can be kept in an indivisible reserve. It contradicts Part 5, Clause 4A.
Let me just go to Advocate Vandamova. And just check.
I can maybe just give some a rule of legislative interpretation. It's where a section has a general application and you have another section that has specific application. The specific application trumps the general application. So what we have here is your specific application is now contradicting the general application, then the interpretation will make the specific one applicable.
And I know I never welcomed you, Advocate Stradham, but you're very welcome and I see you are following everything. Yeah.
I've been sitting here in silence for quite a while. You have rudely interrupted my silence, Madam Chair, but be that as it may, I'm here almost as a backbencher today, but I'm part of the process, Madam Chair, absolutely.
Last word on the subject, Mr. Ndomo, yes.
That's exactly what I was saying, Chair, is that the other provisions of the Act, which are general in nature, applicable to social covenant, with respect only to the specific one, this is the specific one that relates to the social covenant. That's where it trumps the general ones. That's what that is saying. That's the main issue.
Right. We're all agreed now. We have a clear understanding. Page 5, 121, part 5, social co-ops. That was 1, 2, requirements of the Constitution, 3, surplus at the bottom of the page. Honourable Hill Lewis.
I presume the name section can be removed as well. The section 2 on the name, that can be removed as well.
I would imagine so, because we've already made an overall statement, you know. The thing is, I'm just wondering, when you refer to this, what is in the Principal Act as well in this regard, but I think it's you adding this particular section. I just want a word from yourself, then, Advocate van der Merwe, on that.
We can, in fact, simply delete all the sections in all the parts that deal with name, because it is there in the Principal Act already. So we'll go through it. I initially thought to keep the compliance in Section 10, but this question, I actually think we can do away with the whole issue of the name. As long as the name, unless it is something, I think worker and the financials and specified, you must put this word in, that then we can keep it. But I think if it's simply says you must comply, we must comply anyway. So we can delete it if it is unnecessary.
Mr. Domo?
Chair, I have just a different approach. With the requirements of Constitution, because that's where the qualifier is, we must say that requirement of the Constitution is in relation to social cooperatives and specify accordingly in that law, because we need to keep that law as it is, and then it becomes just a new law that is standing on its own in relation to social cooperatives. The rest could then be removed, and the name that goes to that. That's
to keep it. So rather than belabor the point, it's not going to detract from it. It may remove a little bit of elegance, but you know, steady. Let's move on then, page 1, the bottom, requirements of the Constitution and surplus. 122.4. Termination of membership, 5. 1, 2. A, B, C, 3, at the bottom of page 122, 123, 4 and 5, definition 6, no objections. Now we agree, look, let's leave it, it's not doing any harm, let's not try and fix it too much. Right, substitution then, we move on, long title of Act, Act 14, 2005, clause 80. Following long title is hereby substituted for the long title of the Principal Act. Oh, that seems such a back front way of saying it, but do provide, etc. We've all, I'm sure, studied that. I hope we have we? And it goes on to page 124. I know there was something that had come up. What was it? Remember, yes, last week or week, no, this week, in fact, something had come up here that, why haven't we put that in now? To say, was it to do with the substitution of the preamble or something? Wasn't it that remember that issue of, what was it, that, the principles? The principles, yes. Now, has that been captured the way we were hoping it would? Do you remember that? We said, we know we took it out, it's not in the legislation. Was there a need to make a reference to it? Am I correct? Yes. Do you remember that discussion, deliberation, Advocate van der Merwe?
Thank you, Chief Person. Yes, we have noted that. It has not been done in this draft. I made on the on page 125, I've made a note for myself, and I think where it will fit the best, is you'll see the first whereas has a couple of little stars, and then the full paragraph as well as the need to. And if you look at that, that is actually our cooperative principle. So we talk about community development, employment, entrepreneurship, poverty eradication, improved socioeconomic well-being. And I think we can simply add there, in accordance with cooperative principles. So then we have cooperative principles in our preamble, and it makes perfect provision for that.
Honourable Vanda Merva.
I think the point was that we had the cooperative principles in a preamble before. We are now bringing them into the body of the legislation, and we need to say in the long title that that's what we're doing. Do you see what I'm saying? Rather than that to provide for matters connected here with you, to provide for the legalization or the providing of the principle within the act. Isn't that right?
Go in this manner. We've had this proposal from yourself, Honourable Vandenberger, just reminder, Honourable McIntosh, and then we come over here. Yes.
Madam Chair, Honourable Van Madra is almost always got very good, sensible proposals. But I do think that the principle should be in the preamble and not in the long title. So I think what Admiral Mayor is suggesting is a very, to use your terminology, elegant way of including cooperative principles under where we have create environment sections in accordance with cooperative principles. So I think in the preamble that could be useful. And I'm not sure, again, in terms of interpretation, I know technically, I think I'm correct, the long title and the preamble are actually not legally binding. They're not part of the act as such.
That is why we want the principles again in the legislation. But you're quite right. Little reference there where you put it, Honourable Advocate Van der Merwe, and we covered. Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't see a problem with adding it to the long title. We can say to provide for cooperative principles and for compliance with cooperative principles.
That's it. Right. At first page 124, no objections. We've enhanced it. In fact, we did make a little objection. Page 125, the preamble then. Whereas. But we should always read and reread this, you know, just put you in the picture, etc. We move on preamble on page 125 to 126, all the whereases, you remember that, whereas, and then no objection, I'm looking around, no objection, we move. Page 127, substitution of table of contents, Act 14 of 2005, Clause 82, Chapter 1. Now, you know, it's difficult for me, just offhand, to know that this was exactly as it came. And I think it's important for it to be scrutinized by the crafters so that we don't have any error. It's difficult for us directly to do that. Yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I'm back to our definite article again. On page 128, clause 12...
I haven't got there, actually.
Oh, I thought you were dealing with the contents.
Well, I was on page 127, just going down, and now part 1, application to read. Now you talk. Yes, you go ahead, page 128. Yeah, you see, there we are, 127.
Commissioner, I'm just challenging us to see if that is what we mean. The very last line under part 1. Application to register and name. Just to check if that was, to me, if something is a bit vague.
I think it's, again, for us, accessibility of the language. And to register and name. Look, let's just leave that for you to think of. You know, it's accessibility always and how it flows. So we'll keep that there. Page 128, Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you. In this chapter 12 of the contents, it is, I think, definitions. No, chapter 2, section 12, I think it should be unlawful use of the words cooperative and co-op limited. But again, as you say, we are from the 20th century, Madam Chair, not the 21st. So our syntax might be slightly different.
Yes. All I'm doing is trying to locate it. What number is it under on page 128?
It's 12.
12, I also use of the words cooperative and co-op limited. Use of the words. I see what you mean about the... you know, that word missing, what do you call it? The definite article. I was just trying to dredge my own memory from primary school, sorry. Yeah. You know, I think there's nothing modern or etc. I mean, it's not that we're going to Chaucer's Day. It's quite acceptable to put in that. Right. Now, we came to the end of page 128. So, we put in those dots. 129, part 3. Chapter 3, membership of cooperatives, and I'm just going to now just get no objections on each one. Part 1, no objections, we move. Part 2, no objections, we move. Part 3, no objections, we move. Chapter 3, membership of cooperatives, no objections, we move. Chapter 4, page 130, general meetings, we move. On the basis that, you know, the numbers, etc., are... cleared up and confirmed. Chapter 5, management of governance of cooperatives. No objections, we move. Carrying on to 131, chapter 6 there, capital structures. Capital structures. No objections, we move. Chapter 7, ordinary independent review of cooperatives. No objections on page 131, 132. Exemptions, well that's a... Then chapter 8 on page 132, amalgamation, division, conversion and transfer, no objections, 133, page 133, chapter 9, winding up the deregistration of cooperatives. Now objections, chapter 10, page 134, and judicial man, those for those who were asleep. I know that my hands were here at my nose and my mouth, so not to infect colleagues on the list. Page 134. 77, this is a true reflection on Hansard, you see. Chapter 11, no objections, we move. Chapter 12, Cooperatives Advisory Board Council, I hope we've corrected that everywhere. No objections, we move. Page 135, the end of that, and then Chapter 12A, Cooperatives Development Agency, Part 1, Establishment, Legal Status, Functions and Powers of Agency. No objections on that page, we move to page 136. Part 2, Funding and Financial Management Agency. Just while we're running like this, I hope the advocates have got ready and fine-tuned and finalised what we asked them to finalise in two areas. Part 2. Part 3, no objections, we move. Chapter 12E, Cooperatives Tribunal. No objections, we move. Page 137 concludes that side. Chapter 12, CS Governmental Relations, which continues over until 138. No, Honourable Mabasa?
Just 138. Just a question, what is the significance of underlining at this stage now, you know, the 94A and 94B?
What we have here is we're replacing the current index with an index that provides for all the new insertions as well. So anything that's underlined in this index is something new. So it's something that has not been there before.
Chapter 13, miscellaneous provisions.
And in 139,
yes, 94b of chapter 13, what then becomes the relevance of that in the light of the earlier correction? It does still have to be there.
Yes, Advocate.
Thank you, Justice. That will be part of the consequential amendment. So we'll have to decide whether we call it administrative support or whatnot, and then this will be there as well.
It's going to be a lot of proofreading on this. Schedule 1, special provisions relating to certain kinds of cooperatives, part 1, housing, workers, financial, agricultural, social, was added. Do you see that there? Right. Substitution of expressions, and that's why we have to look very carefully at when we remove that duplicated issue. Substitution of expressions in Act 14, 2005. 83. Our objections there, short title and commencement of Act, clause 84. This Act is called the Cooperatives Amendments Act 2012 and comes into operation on a date fixed by the President by proclamation in the Gazette. And then I've got, just going through page 140, of course the memorandum is not really part of the legislation. But in one sense, we need to assure that it now reflects what is in the legislation. So let's just ensure that that is the case. Page 141. Yes, Honourable Mabaza?
Just to be sure that on the title on 140, are we sure we want to say memorandum of the objects is it objects or is it objectives, just asking my mind.
You know, the thing is, I must say, we've always asked this and then they've said objects. But, it's one of these legal jargon terms that I think I can live with. Yeah, all right. But talking about jargon and your little commas and ors, state law advisor, I haven't forgotten that or issue. And the point I made about us putting in all the ors, and that's why I pointed out in one of the other sections, you suddenly put in all the ors. It may not have been you, of course. Advocate Small.
Yes, Chair, thanks. The area that the Chair has indicated is actually, I just liaised with my peer here, is correct as stands there. Nevertheless, Chair, I have liaised very intensely with many of my colleagues at the office with regard to the ors and the ands, and we basically put it down to a grammatical type of syntax where if one reads it all in one in grammar, you would say the cat comma, dog comma, cow comma, and then you would put at the last penultimate, you'll say, and the mouse. And in this instance, we're just focusing it more into a list form and we emphasizing it with the semicolons. Rather than a comma, and then at the penultimate we put to the and. So we also liaised Thornton on legislative drafting, and there's no clear indication, but what I can say to the committee is that once this bill goes for proofing, it is also dealt with the legislative office of Mr. Bell. And we will be going through it together. And most times, Mr. Bell indicates further comments, further restructure of sentences. And he will also be commenting on ors and ands. And I can clearly put to the committee that Mr. Bell will remove those ors and ands. But I could motivate if the committee really wants. But again, I also indicate to the committee the other day that part of the principle actually remains with the ors and the ands. And so it's going to be very difficult unless for a new piece of legislation.
but we need to comply or conform to Principal Act 2.
Now, I think we've heard enough. Suffice to say, Mr. Bell doesn't adopt legislation, we do. And I think I'm sure Mr. Bell knows this. And we are the lawmakers here, not Mr. Bell. So we obviously are very keen to get advice, but in the end we make the decision. And our decision is accessibility. And unless there's a constitutional impediment to that, which I'd like to see, we're going to stick to our oars. Right? Please, I will write myself to Mr. Bell then, but I really think he would agree with me, probably think I was joking, but he knows I'm serious. Page 141. But I do appreciate, Advocate Small, that you took it seriously enough to do consultation. And I think that that is what is at stake here. We don't have state law advisors who have a cavalier attitude, but take the points we make very seriously. To me, that is very important. I do thank you. But as you also point out, that little grey blue book of yours ain't got anything in. Right. Page 141. 3. No objections there, so we move. And this, as I said, it's not a question of objections. Now, we were really just coming to the memorandum. But I did say the memorandum should reflect the legislation. It shouldn't just be out of the blue. And I'm now going to ask you for the two areas, ethics and murder. What is this new one you're looking at today, right here, page?
I will find now that this is one,
Honourable Ma'am.
Well, I have three general points to make, which I was waiting patiently for the end, if I could make those general.
Yes, we're at the end, though.
Oh.
No, we're just getting this one, another amendment draft, cross. Is it Betty?
Yes, and the one in respect of the repayment, I would simply propose that Alison made a slight adjustment which incorporated the 2-year maximum, which resolved it. So as you read it, with that slight change of the 2 years,
okay.
That would be fine. And then I'm sorry, I cannot recall another big one that we had to draft. It could be the chief director, but I think that is probably...
We've already agreed.
We've agreed on that, and I think the only thing that we'll just have to decide is what to call it. Do we call it administrative support, so the department must provide administrative support that does, instead of chief director. So I think that actually a tiny amount.
On that particular note, I want to thank all those who participated in crafting the team that we have here in front of us. And also, I know the state law advisor is now going to be saddled with this and to go through clause by clause. And I just want to indicate we do appreciate that. We know you're under pressure, but we do. And that's a very important role that is played here for us. With respect to the committee, did you want to comment before I just close off now? Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Honourable Vandermeer, you also have three general points, and then Honourable Abbas.
I thought on page 142, I would propose that the secretary, Mr. Hemmings, looks carefully at the bodies that made inputs, because I get the feeling that he has missed some. So if the meeting allows that, just so that meeting allows that.
I think that will be on a secretariat fund, because the memorandum is with you. But of course it's important to note who we saw and who we didn't, yes. Advocate Vandermeer.
Chairperson, we must just remember that the memorandum of object is the executive's consultation. So the consultation by this committee will be done in a report that accompanies the bill.
To be sure, we did have something once on gambling and it turned out there was some sort of change that had to be made here, and the executive picked that up. But, Honourable, we've now come to the end. Before I make a ruling, do you want to make a comment, Honourable Vandermeer?
Yeah, you were moving along so smoothly and swiftly that I thought I would wait for the end because these things that I want to say apply generally throughout the bill. The first one actually wasn't that. It's that the question of the agency, if you look on page 3, agency is defined as agency, not the agency. So I would say the first point was correct. No need to say the agency because it's defined in the bill as agency. The second point I want to make is that right throughout the bill, and I've noted it on two pages, 54 and 128, when we talk about National Apex Co-op, we must have a the in front of that. And it's not there. And I would just ask the drafters or really the proofreaders, to make sure that it talks about the National Apex, because that is a principal point. The third thing is, going through it like this, it's clear that nobody is going to read this, who is a cooperative. Possibly a tertiary or the Apex will read this bill. The lawyers are going to read this bill. And I think for that reason we've been very careful about what we're going to do. It's very complex. And I therefore want to stress again my original proposal that we get a booklet that will be designed to help cooperatives understand what their responsibilities are. And I think we should ask the department to produce it in a certain amount of time after the government gazette on the bill. That's what I want to say.
Do we all agree with that position? Yes. So that's adopted. I'm going to come to you last, Albert, but I just want to go to Honourable Mabasa. Is it on this issue, Honourable Mabasa?
All right, thank you, Chair. I'll support the issue of the booklet, which must come in all the languages, because some of these corporate applies all the level languages, really possible.
Right. I'm just going to hear what the members have said first. Honourable Mabasa.
We've covered one of the points I wanted to make. It's just that he didn't put enough weight on Braille, but just putting more weight on Braille. And then the last point from myself that day when I sent members of the team, the task team, I have skipped Ukemuth, and your name is added on those tremendous members of the task team. Ms. Ukemuth, thanks.
Forever carved in stone, from what I hear. But I think what we need to do is more than that. We need to thank you. That's where I wanted to come. We need to thank you personally, Honourable Mabasa, for chairing a very important piece of legislation and doing it with such informed leadership of the principles that we want to see clearly reflected in this legislation. And yes, we thank all the members of the subcommittee. You've now got a taste, Honourable Wong, of how strenuous it is, the activity. And that's why we don't get too many takers to sit on subcommittees. But thank you very, very much for being there. We ought to say now to the department, the booklet, which we were asked about deadlines, etc. You know, we like to be reasonable, we like to be realistic, but for me this is one of the few pieces of legislation that I can honestly say, without that booklet, like the budget coming out, you get a little explanatory thing, it's almost impossible for it to be accessible to the very people you're targeting. So it becomes a matter of urgency, and it may be work in progress with all of the languages, but you've got to make a start. Even if it is like a one card printed on two sides to make that kick off and then move. So please, we are appealing to the department. In our report, we're going to put a deadline. Thank you, Chief Director.
Chairperson, I undertake commitment, and this is what we're going to do, is to produce the booklet and via it to committee, so that you could see the material as how simplified it is, and where possible, some of the few languages together with the Braille, which you could then take it through you. It's something that this agent will put it, and we've got a budget and line up for it to deliver on it. That's it.
I'd like to just ask one thing from Mr. Herman. I really don't want to go backwards on that. We can do it under the next meeting, because we're running out of time on Norma Basa. Yes, yes, your comments, I think we need to ask the sermons when we are adopting this. Because at the moment we're taking it through to the printers, it comes back, proofreading, am I right? And the final, the proofread one, the printed credo copy, is adopted.
The meeting is scheduled for 1st of November, immediately after the house sitting.
It is very important that you are all there. You will get this before, I hope, just before, so that you can check all those sensitive parts, please. I want to thank all of the people here who participated, all of the experts, all of the advocates, all of the members of the DGI. And yes, Honourable Hildes, because I'm closing off with the Basa on all the Basa.
I think we must especially thank those who spent so much time in Cape Town away from their families in Pretoria.
I'm not aware who was in Pretoria, but yes, Honourable Hildes.
Just a long adjective used by the chief director, some few languages. All the 11 languages and braille. That was all.
But I think what we said, and I qualified it, I said, you're going to start off immediately with the one card printed on two sides. You can't immediately in 1 week print every language, and that's what we're saying. We need this, and we need to work it out ourselves. What is a realistic deadline to give them? I don't want to give it now, that's what I'm saying. I want us to think about it before we say, because when we give you that deadline, we're going to mention it in the house. Right. So on that particular note, but I do take your point, Honourable Hill Lewis. Those who live in Pretoria, Johannesburg, rural parts of KZN, and you name it, they were all here away from home. I know some people, you have to just about do a 4x4 and then walk, helicopter, etc. Thank you. So all of you, thank you. We're now speedily moving forward to deal with the NCR. Now, I hope, Ms. Ivinson, you come for that last day, or at least in the house of the debate. Mr. Jeff and Dorma, Chief Director, and your team, a sincere thanks. Right, we now move straight, National Credit Regulator. We are going to go straight into it, but I just want to call the whip up here for 1 minute, please, while this changeover is taking place.
Thank you. Happy to appear in this committee Yes, Chair, we do agree that we do need to give regular feedback to the committee so that you don't read about some of these things in the paper. And in this particular case, we think it is actually opportune for us to come back because there have been a number of activities that are taking place that our regulator, the NPR, has embarked on. They will obviously today cover some of the statistics, the recent statistics around the credit market, and they also, you know, update us of some of the investigations that they are looking at. And as everyone is aware, they are a regulator. There are limitations in terms of, you know, the extent to which they can get into an investigation and talk about it in this forum. So there would be limitations, but they would give you a sense of what they are dealing with. And they will also look into some of the issues and some of the challenges around the debt cancelling issues. Chair, I just want to also just indicate that the committee is aware that the amendment to the Credit Act is on our parliament, on the parliamentary program, and we are working hard on that, and we do want to make sure that at least we can introduce those amendments bill in this financial year. And those amendments will see, I think, a whole lot of gaps and loopholes closed, because what is happening right now in the credit market results from some of those loopholes, and also some of the gaps, I think, in terms of the powers that we have in the NCA. And we would look into that when we bring those amendments here. And we hope that the committee will also just expedite that, because there's a whole lot of impact on consumers at this moment, and we want to close that gap as soon as possible. Chair, also you'll note that we are currently working on the possibilities of looking around the credit amnesty, and the NCR is working with the team in the DTI in regards to that space, and then we'll be giving some feedback in due course on that. But I must assure the committee that a whole lot of work is happening around that space. And I'm going to hand over, Chair, to the CEO and her team to take the committee through that, and then as the department will come in there and there, where we need to come in. But I must say, Chair, that the issues around unsecured lending, they still remain a concern for us as the department, but also some of the practices that are now emanating, which we thought when we passed the NCA, we thought we are getting rid of them. We are seeing them resurfacing in different forms. So I think the NCR will then be in a position to give you in terms of some of the strategies that they will apply to do with those things. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DDG. And over to yourselves now, Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Motsigane.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Committee Members, and good morning to you all. And thank you, DDG, for that introduction. I'm going to take the Honourable Chair and the Committee Members through, you know, our work as the National Credit Regulator. And these are the topics that I'm going to cover. I'd like to request something quickly, Honourable Chair. Sorry. I see that, you know, the slides are moving very quickly, and I'm not going to be able to present in that, you know, at that speed. Please excuse me.
We just need our parliamentary liaison officer in being able just to assist.
Okay.
So that it doesn't run ahead of you.
Yes,
that's
correct.
It.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Thank you very much. I thought I just, you know, we needed to give you a sense of, you know, where we are with unsecured credit. And in, you know, in the rate at which it's been extended to consumers in the country. Currently, we continue to see, you know, unsecured credit being extended to consumers at a fast rate by credit providers. As you can see from that, you know, slide, unsecured credit has increased by 39% year on year. Meaning that in June last year, between June last and June this year, the increase has been 49%. And at the same time, whilst there's been an increase in the extent in which, you know, unsecured credit has been extended, there's also been an increase in consumers that are considered to have impaired records. These are consumers who are 3 and more months in arrears in with regards to the payment, you know, payment of loans. But also, there's also been an increase in adverse listings. This means, you know, more legal action has been taken by credit providers in this regard. The information that we also receive from TransUnion, you know, gives us the same trend. Clearly, distressed household borrowing remains a concern, because we see that the credit health of consumers, even in Q3 2012, continues to deteriorate. So, and our numbers already, talk to what TransUnion has on the books. It also talks to the research that has been done at, Finscope and DMR, which is, your unit, a wing that looks into household indebtedness. So, it is very clear that consumers are distressed. Now, in terms of the credit analysis, the gross debtors book sits at $1.36 trillion. This is the outstanding book, the amount of money that has been lent to consumers. And unsecured credit, constitutes 9.6% of that $1.36 trillion. And unsecured credit, as I said, increased 49% year on year. And the value of the gross debtors book for unsecured credit reported as current has decreased. This means that the performance of that credit product, when you compare it with other credit products like mortgages, short-term loans, secured credit, its performance is worse than other credit products. Because the other credit products, in terms of when they are credit as current, they sit at 80% and above. But it's only unsecured credit that sits lower than the rest of the other credit products. Increasing consumers with impaired records, as I said, there's been a 47% increase. 60% of the unsecured credit is targeted at people earning 15,000 rand per month. This is in terms of the debt that we have at our disposal. Now, we should also take cognizance of the fact that since the introduction of the Act, gradually you get people who are earning more than 50,000 a month that are continuing to also get unsecured credit because the size of the loans are also increasing. Even the repayment period of those loans is increasing. Currently, on average, people are given 4 to 5 years to pay, loans up to 230,000. So more and more people who are earning more than 50,000 a month are also, getting access to this credit. But currently, 60% of the value, in terms of the rent value, of unsecured is targeted at people earning less than 15,000. This is in terms of the set at end of June 2012. Now, what is the NCR doing about this? Part of our interventions includes, obviously, and the DDG has alluded to that, proposals for amendment of the Act so that we close those gaps. Introduction of the repayment multiple, but this will also be included in the amendments that will be, brought into the DTR. Affordability assessment principle based guidelines. We don't want to go the rule-based, guidelines because we feel that it's a business decision that must be taken by credit providers. Consumer education, we need to find new ways of disseminating, information to consumers. We need to find new ways of targeting or reaching consumers, especially in rural areas. And we will be doing that. We already have plans as the NCR to do that from this financial year. We will continue to monitor levels of unsecured lending against, consumer indebtedness, and therefore we'll be watching the space and looking at information that we get from credit bureaus and credit providers on a more regular basis. We have started with our proactive compliance monitoring, exercises and investigations, will continue. And in terms of proactive compliance monitoring, what we used to do is we would request information from credit providers to see whether they comply with the Act. But we have started making visits now and demanding information so that we can see and assist credit providers to comply with the Act. Because we feel we don't necessarily always have to apply the stick. We need to do this, in a holistic manner. And in terms of proactive investigations, we conducted raids at pension payout points in Northern Cape, Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and Northwestern provinces. We did this jointly with SAPS, and we managed to get a number of micro-lenders arrested. And there were criminal cases that were opened. And as indicated, we focused attention to outpoint target micro lenders who are retaining consumers, ATM cards, PIN numbers, and pension cards. Ongoing raids will continue the raids in other provinces. Other ongoing investigations, we are currently busy with, two big investigations, one around ATM loans and multiple loans, and this is, you know, investigation. The major culprits here are banks. We have finalized those investigations and we are reviewing the reports. We are also looking at the cost of credit because we know that they, you know, a number of credit providers are not compliant with the Act in the sense that they continue to charge excessive interest and fees. And we saw that in Arizona. Credit life insurance as a, you know, as a product is also being abused in the market, and therefore we will be making proposals, you know, or we might be decided to go the guideline route before we, you know, propose regulations to be changed around that to limit the cost of credit life because it is being abused. But currently there is a task team that has been formed to look at the abuses in the market. And this task team comprised the NCR, Treasury, FSB, and the Competition Commission to look at the abuses in the credit life insurance. Our credit investigations, I just wanted to, you know, cite an example in Arizona. Those are the contraventions that we picked up. You know, credit providers that are not doing proper vulnerability assessment whenever they grant loans to consumers. There's no proper disclosure on the cost of credit. Pre-agreement codes are not being given to consumers. I mean, the whole idea around pre-agreement codes is to allow consumers to be able to shop around and, you know, decide on the best deal. Some, you know, consumers are not even being given, you know, contracts. Interest and fees, as I indicated, you know, consumers are being overcharged. And there are those credit providers that continue to retain bank cards and PINs. And compliance with Section 129 of the National Credit Act, where, for instance, you know, consumers are already over-indebted, in terms of that agreement that you want to enter into, you find credit, you know, the credit agreement is excluded from debt review. And we don't think that was in the spirit of the Act, but that forms part of the, you know, the Act amendments. There are some credit providers who continue to engage in this practice and yet they are not registered with the NCR, even though they are part in terms of the threshold to be registered with the National Credit Regulator. And one of the big compliance, you know, non-compliance issues that we picked up was around the black process documents that are signed by consumers. Consumers are led to, you know, sign agreements, and when they leave, obviously what normally happens is that the credit providers that enter the information that were never in agreement with the consumer. So in terms of the enforcement action that we are going to be taking around that, already the way our arrests are made, we are going to be referring, you know, these matters to the National Consumer Tribunal. And I want to propose, you know, either deregistration of those credit providers or imposition of fines. The challenges that we have around debt cancelling, we've got 800 active debt cancellers currently. And we picked up that there are delays and bottlenecks in the process in the sense that once they reach the court, you find these matters are sometimes postponed. There are backlogs at the court. In our engagements with magistrates, for instance, in Limpopo, you know, we were made to understand by some magistrates that they don't quite understand the debt cancelling process, and therefore we are going to be embarking on workshops, you know, countrywide with magistrates. We already started in Limpopo. There's also the challenge around, you know, forum shopping, you know, by some debt cancellers and lawyers who would rather go to those courts that don't quite understand the cancelling process and just rubber stamps whatever it is that they need to be done. Legal fees remain a challenge, especially for consumers who cannot afford lawyers, you know, to fight their cases to the court. And therefore, we will, you know, I'll take you through what we intend to do in that regard. And lack of cooperation from credit providers, which has led to, you know, for instance, the establishment of the voluntary debt mediation solution, or it is a pilot that banks wanted to set up, which we had to stop as a regulator because we felt that it was in contravention of the Act. We wrote to the CEOs of the banks and they have assured us that they have stopped the pilot and they'll continue to support the statutory debt cancelling mechanism. Now, some of the proposed solutions is, you know, to prevent, this is in terms of amendments of the Act, you know, and I've highlighted that. And our engagement with the magistrate is to, you know, propose establishment of specialized dedicated debt cancelling courts, but understand, for instance, that housing is a province ahead of a number of provinces in that regard because they do have those specialized courts. We'll continue to do our training, you know, with the magistrates on debt cancelling matters. We already had a meeting with the chief magistrate in Gauteng, and they're willing to avail their senior magistrates to assist us in training, you know, debt cancellers. We will also try to identify NGOs and other organizations that can provide free legal service, you know, pro bono work to deserving consumers under their review. We've already had those discussions with the chief magistrates in Gauteng, and they're willing, you know, to assist us in that regard, to at least facilitate that process. I thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. We will take questions at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very, very enlightening presentation. It certainly has already managed to clarify one or two areas. Thank you very much indeed, CEO. I'm looking on my list of members now, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Mabasa, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Van der Merwe, Honourable Huang. Could just come forward or go back, yes.
Thanks very much, Chair. Thanks to the NCR for the presentation. Firstly, I just wanted, it's just a question of clarity on numbers. Your very first slide indicates that 20%, 25% in fact, of the gross debtor book is UC. But then on your third slide it says 9.6%. So it's more than double. I just want to check which it is actually, which of those figures is incorrect. Then you recently said, I think it was on Moneyweb, I heard the interview, I think it was with you, ma'am, that you're conducting an investigation into Capitec, FNB and Africa Bank. Is that the case, and what is the status of that investigation? And then if you could simply explain very briefly what a repayment multiple is. I'm not quite clear what a repayment, introduction of a repayment multiple. And then, you know, this very popular perception that there's a bubble in unsecured credit. When one looks at the numbers, and I refer also to the last presentation you gave us, which had a lot more numbers than this one, but even in this one, at 9.6 of the total debtor book, still smaller far smaller than advances in less, you know, the lesser secured forms of credit like furniture stores and that kind of thing. And still obviously smaller than mortgage advances. I mean, is there really that much evidence of a bubble forming in this particular sector of the market? It seems to me just to be popular hype. I mean, I completely agree that there's some very dangerous practices and trends, but there doesn't seem to be much evidence based on the information you've given us in this report and in the previous one of a bubble per se. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. We then had Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Thanks for the input. It really makes us to understand where we are. I'm just asking if the experience of Marikana is informing us to be proactive, you know, nationally, whether, I know it's challenges on capacity, but I think we must face that challenge so that we don't get shocked. And then the second point is on slide 5, the first 5, because I've got two, let me then say, it is a slide that says NCR interventions on consumer education. I think what would be critical is that when we say to people, don't borrow money that comes at such a cost, don't borrow money to people that may hold you to ransom, but we should also say the alternatives are these. So I know that to spell out alternatives is bigger than NCR because it needs the whole government, but those minimum alternatives must be articulated. And then the next slide, which is proactive investigations, it's whether there's a strategy that when the people that abuse the micro-lending principles, whether they are publicized, enough, because if there is poor publicity, we will find it is more difficult for the department. That was my last one, it's called the chair effects.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabasa. Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I must tell you, I feel very comfortable with the National Credit Regulator. I think it's fantastic that we have this legislation. I think it's very important that we know where we're going. I agree with Honourable Hill Lewis, the so-called bubble and so on is just, again, media hype. And I think South Africans have learnt to always not respond to media hype, because the media often completely exaggerate, they want an angle and they want a story, and before you know what's happened, things a few days or weeks later have all calmed down. And but of course the eager journalist has got her or his headline, which is what they wanted. But I really think our National Credit Act is good, and I think we're doing a good job. My concern is two things in this report. The one is the emphasis on Marikana, and the second one is to try, I believe, for us to understand where low-income people are coming from. Now, I deliberately am not using the word poor. I'm using low-income people. So you have, and I think one of the things you learned from Marikana is almost all those people who were shot came from the former Transcar. They were Xhosa-speaking miners. And what do they do when they get their money? They want to loan. The wife sends a message. They've got to get some school fees. They might even want to buy a cell phone. Now, they're not rich, but they have an income, and they have a good job, and now they want money. Now, as I see it, our challenge, and the regulator, I think the challenge, is how do we, without nannying our total population, we try to make sure that they're not exploited. Because if we raise the thresholds too high, those people will go and find money. Or somebody will become illegal. It'll just go underground. There'll be a black market in lending. And that will be much more unscrupulous than Capitec or African Bank or anything like that. So I think that's what we want to avoid. And I really think we need to have a sensitivity for, if you want to call it, unsophisticated maybe, but because they're not necessarily poor. But Madam Chair, my concern is that most of us and the credit regulators don't understand compound interest. And I mean, my father brought me up to understand. You don't have debt, or if you do have debt, you know what you're paying, how much it is. And one sees this with people. They buy expensive flat-screen TVs, and you can't believe that they spend so much money. But the point is they're enjoying the TV now. So they don't realize what it's costing them in terms of interest and credit. And they want that money now to send back to the Transcar. So I think that we need to have sensitivity there. And our presenter did say that it's a credit risk. The creditor must do it. And ultimately, we can't nanny everybody in our society. I mean, people have got to accept responsibility for the risks they take. I think what we want to know is that they are better educated and realize the risks. But for many of the people, they say, well, so what? I've got my flat screen TV. I can watch the football and my soap. I don't mind what it costs. I've got it now. I'm enjoying it. So I think we need to just deal with that one. Then on the question of Marikana, you know, Madam Chair, it's not what in our presentation, but we've had a document from our research department, which is very interesting. But they quote a consultant who is anonymous, who endeavours to link the irrecoverable and unsustainable indebtedness amongst miners, and then he talks about unravelling the potential link between the illegal strikes that happened at Marikana and the unscrupulous behaviour of unsecured personal loans.
Now, Madam Chair, I mean, just speaking for myself, that is a very serious and a very worrying sort of comment. Now, if it's true, and I'm not saying it's not true, but I think one of the very good things our President has done is to appoint a commission of inquiry into Marikana. Because all these stories, what we call amahemohemo, can be exposed. And I think if somebody believes that, and they are a reputable debt consultant, it's incumbent on that man or woman to give evidence to that inquiry. Just as I think it's incumbent on the Isangomas, who sold the Muji.
Yeah, but now I have the evidence got to do with the unsecured lending itself. As serious as it is. Honourable Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair, and it's always nice to hear from the NCR people who always give us a lot of very good and solid information. I do not agree necessarily with my colleagues that this is a bubble that's hyped up by the media. And I think proof of that is the interventions that you've made and discovered really problematic contraventions of the Act and the arrests and so on. I think it is something that we need to worry about to prevent it from getting any worse. And I think that's what the purpose of this organization and the Act is. There was a study that you did, I think, the last time you came. I think you were in the middle of it, and I guess some of this information is a result of that study. But what I would like to see, and you've probably got the information, but I'd like to see it put differently, who are the main culprits? Because I have a sense that in addition to the small micro-lenders, the Mashonisa, and so on, the banks are actually quite a big culprit. I have a sense of that, but I would like to see it in numbers. I think if it's 9% or 11%, it's a horrific amount of the debt book that is an unsecured lending, because that means a little family is going to the bank to borrow money to put food on the table for the next week before the next, and then they must pay that, and it's a trap. And I think it is a point of huge concern, because it infects those people earning under 15,000 rand a month, and they are the ones that we need to protect. I think I don't agree with the nanny state thing. People don't understand finance. I certainly didn't when I was earning under 15,000. They don't understand finance. They don't understand compound interest. It just looks easy. I would like to also ask for a little bit more information on VDMS. It's my initials, so I'm very concerned about a Fundamerva suit. And I want to know what Fundamental Sue is doing, basically disguised an unregulated form of debt counseling. I heard what you said, but I'm just not sure how that worked, and the fact that the banks were doing it and it was illegal and they've agreed to stop, I think is a credit to you, but I think it's outrageous that these institutions are pillars of our society. Are actually engaging in illegal stuff, and we have to persuade them to stop. So, our VDMS is a point of great concern to me. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, then, Honourable Madam Over. We now move to Honourable Huang. Am I correct? Yes.
Okay, I've just got a few questions. The one which I will be very interested on is with the Marikana case, because I'm also, one of my other portfolios is mining resources. So that's a very crucial topic for me to get more feedback on that, on more investigations of what actually happened and who the players were and why it's resulted in the situation it has. So I think that's one. Comments from my colleague, Mr. Hill Lewis, that on page 2, can you explain how you actually got to the 49% calculation? As it stands there, it doesn't seem like it's very correct. Okay. Then the next question is, for reckless lending, I think that's one of the major concerns. Now, as I understand the market, that
it's the big players, such as the banks and the new entrants, the big corporates that actually come in and to attract customers, they go and they do the affordability, the guidelines for the affordability, but for the cap on how much they can actually borrow, lend a person, that's how they actually attract the customers. But with them constantly increasing that amount, that as I understand it, is the main problem, because once that happens, basically you're killing the chicken that hatches the egg, basically. So it actually puts them into the debt counseling and puts them into it actually puts them into going into administration, if I remember correctly. And that causes more problems. It's the reckless lending. So is there a cap or a suggestion of how much, once you can see the person is affordable, of affordability, I know every single company has got its own mechanism or calculation of actually calculating how much they can lend. So the main problem is the big financial corporates which actually go there and actually increase that amount just to attract the customers, which put them into more debt. I think that's one of the main ones. And also, as I understand it, on one of your points, you've got excessive interest and excessive fees. As I understand it, the fees hasn't actually increased for the past number of years, which I know is also a major concern for the actual corporates. With all increasing of wages and salaries and administration costs, wouldn't be likely that it should be increasing, but obviously you indicate that it's excessive of fees. Could you explain? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable One. I have one or two myself. I see some of them are covered. Just looking at slide 7, for example, you've got here investigations, proactive investigations, and of course some of the points you've highlighted here under my corner, I see that purely as an example, and it is fairly prolific, as it were. Now, one of them is the blank process documents signed by consumers. And it came to our attention that the emoluments, orders that are done, attachment orders, are in fact people are persuaded at the time of the loan, and you made some reference to that, to provide a signature on the dot. And then, of course, a garnishy order thereafter happens or goes straight to the employer. And I wonder what measures you are contemplating in this direction, because usually this sort of thing is on a one-to-one, and you have the one side, the person making the loan, assuring you that they explained all of X, and on the other side someone saying, you didn't, as he says, you know, etc. So it would be of value to learn exactly what you have done in that regard, what you've been able to do. Mine is linked to one of the other ones linked to a couple of the other questions that have come up. The increase, unsecured credit increase, assuming then that their 49% is correct, okay, that's where I'm coming from. I think then that is an untenable. Have a look, the researcher did some work for us, and most people have got that, and if you look around internationally, you know, the credit increase year on year of 49% is actually quite untenable. And I don't think it's something that any country in the current global economic crisis can ignore at all. The other point is you refer to ATMs here at some point, and I see on TV, when one does something like Wongo Wango or something, and you know, all you've got to do is Wongo or something, she says, is, you know, to get your 8,000 is just pick up the phone and say hello, and you're getting this 8,000 somewhere. Now, it would be of value to us to know what are the requirements in that regard, because what we seem to be creating is not simply a poverty trap, a debt trap, but a poverty trap. We're actually now creating a new type of worker. the impoverished employed, the poor employed. We're creating a new level of poverty here so that one's funds are immediately taken. And I know of people who have to stand outside the ATM at midnight to withdraw some money for food, because if they don't, within the first 3 minutes or 5 minutes, entire wages have gone. There's got to be a limit to what can be taken off. And I'm not sure what role debt counters play in that regard. And finally, on the BDM, is just one point. Was it never criminal that people adopted such a cavalier attitude towards it? You know, banks. I'm just surprised that they thought they could just go down that street. Did they just knowingly commit criminal offences? I don't know. It sounds quite odd to me. Or was this is this a borderline case, and what the DDD mentioned about legislation having to be reviewed, loopholes addressed, etc. Thank you, and thank you to members. I know that this is very serious, and we do regard it as such. And over to yourself, CEO, and your team.
Thank you, Honourable Jen. I will also ask my team members to chip in. Just to address the 9.6 versus the 49% increase. The 9.6 constitutes the unsecured proportion of the unsecured credit within the total 1.136 trillion industry. Okay, that's what constitutes unsecured credit. Now, the 49% talks to the increase in unsecured credit from June, between June last year, increase from June last year to June this year. Honourable Chair, the gentleman is reading the test. I'm not quite
sure. No. I'm telling you to comment. At least on this issue.
Yes.
But then do let the CEO and then you come back with that.
Yes. And although we understand that the 9.6, it's considered to be a drop in the ocean in as far as, consumer credit is concerned, and that it doesn't quite lead to a bubble. Remember, the NCR, we are not, we don't monitor financial stability. That's not the bank's problem. We are worried about the impact that this has on consumers, because we are about consumer protection. We have people who are committing suicide because they are over-indebted. We have people who are getting their assets repossessed, by credit providers because they cannot meet their financial obligations. So our regulation really comes from a consumer protection angle. And that's why we are worried at the extent at which this loan is extended to consumers. And the ways, the methods that are used to incentivize people to take on more unsecured credit, when you have a record of that, people who continue to be over-indebted. And we will not apologize for that as the National Credit Regulator, because we are very worried about the impact of unsecured credit on consumers.
Just at that point, is there something you wanted in your question to be more clearly understood?
Yeah, I was asking about the 25% indicated on the first slide. The first slide indicates that unsecured credit as percentage of total credit is 25%. Not 9.3% as indicated further on. I wanted to know which was correct between 9.3 and 25.
I'm unable to follow these page numbers because my page one does not say that at all.
Apologies, it's page two. The first graph, I mean, page two.
Okay, right. I think Honourable Hill Lewis has just corrected himself as well. He corrected himself on Lord Mackintosh in 2. Yes, you did. You say no, the graph on page 2, not page 1 per se. We're talking purely of where it's located.
Honourable, I don't see the 25%. What is that?
Oh, that. Talking purely to the graph itself.
Yeah.
You haven't, you're right. Okay? And then as you come across here, you'll see it hits that graph. If you go to the right, you'll see that last black arrow, and to the left of that black arrow
one of the blocks, am I right, on that graph, hitting the 25% line. I think now we're all on the same page, right?
Your vertical numbers, that was an error. Can I ask you to ignore that and just look at the percentage increase? Thank you.
We'll ask you so we can have a fresh graph. You know, then we're quite clear about it. Is that in order with everyone? Fine, thank you. Because that question of the 25 then was an error in the graph, so would you carry on then with a substantive explanation there?
The interview with Money Web, the investigations manager was one who was being interviewed by Money Web. As with journalists, they will want to see, you know, they want to find out why it is that the NCR had not visited the bank, you know, the banks, and, you know, one of the questions that was asked by the journalist was, you know, is NCR afraid of the banks? Is that the reason why you're just targeting microlenders? I mean, it was we had a plan in place, and our plan suggested that, you know, we indicated to the investigations manager that they must target, you know, the microlenders just before they go to the banks. So the banks were in line to be visited. But, you know, journalists, you know, the poor investigations manager then said, look, we are not afraid of the banks because we have investigated banks before. You know, we have banks registered in the NCR such as Capitec, Invertec, FNB, and African Bank. And in as far as Madonna is concerned, we had not at that point in time visited the NCR. That's where, you know, that's how the whole interview, the whole, you know, issue around the banks that have been investigated came about. But yeah, I mean, the banks, we always investigate banks. Multiple talks to a number that, you know, a correct number that we want consumers to be able to see whenever they sign up on a credit agreement. We want them to be able to see that if I take a 15,000 loan today and I pay it over 3 years, it's cheaper than if I were to pay it over a period of 6 years. And therefore to say, you know, whether the loan that you are taking, ultimately when you repay, you'll have paid, you know, 2 times the amount or 5 times the amount. And that's the repayment multiple that we are looking at. Because currently the pre-agreement code only looks about the total repayment amount. And it's sometimes very difficult for some consumers to understand that you actually pay more, you know, for the same amount of loan over a longer period of time than you would, you know, over a shorter period of time. But we want to introduce that in the pre-agreement code so that it's very easy, you know, for them to compare apples. The experience in Marikana, NCR to be more proactive, yes. We want to always be on the ball and make sure that, you know, when things happen, we're already there, which is exactly what happened in Marikana. We will all appreciate that, you know, the environment was volatile for some time, but we knew, obviously, that if people were not going to work, where, you know, there's no work and no pay, and there were no pay, it means that there are people who are going to be, you know, approaching credit providers to ask for loans. And our concern was that when you have a huge number of people lining up to take on credit, you are bound to start cutting balance to make sure that you get a sizable market share. And therefore, that's the reason why we set out, you know, our team to Marikana to do that investigation. And we continue to conduct these raids as, you know, we did in other provinces, which we visited, you know, prior to the Marikana episode. Slide 5, I'm going to ask the Chief Operations Officer to talk to consumer education and what you're doing in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and members. As an NCR, we do have an education, both an education and enforcement strategies in place. As far as the education strategy is concerned, we very, very much aware that we need to be reaching all the four corners of the country to educate people about lending and everything that is related to that. What we're going to do currently is that we are partnering with the likes of the trade unions, because we have identified the fact that it's mainly your civil servants, your teachers, your colleagues and all that are entitled and that are earning these many loans, you know, and insurance policies and all that. So we're going to target them and the rural as well. So we're going to do this with the likes of your COSATUs, your SATUs, and so on. We have also engaged with the National Youth Development Agency so that we can be able to infiltrate, you know, the youth of the country at large, and particularly at schools and so forth. We are also thinking of coming up with billboards at strategic places like taxi ranks, for example. We're thinking of renting some buses and taxis so that the message can be rolled out to as many people as possible. Previously, we have engaged with Soul City. We had this particular TV program wherein SDR messages were flighted, and it was very, very effective. We are also exploring other opportunities. One other thing that we're looking at is coming up with satellite offices. This is still in a baby stage. We're negotiating with our principals on this particular one because it's going to be costly and so forth. But national footprint is very, very important. And the sooner we have satellite offices in most of the provinces, I think people will get to know about the NCR, and then some people can just walk into offices and so forth, because, you know, most of our people do not have access to your internet and so forth. And we will continue with as the CEO has already indicated, as fire enforcement is concerned, visible enforcement, we will continue to visit the mining towns and other rural areas and all the other credit providers, because we believe that they should be knowing that a regulator is in town and being in business about regulation and protection of consumers.
Honorable Chair, I'm going to ask the company secretary to talk to the voluntary debt mediation solutions at the BDMS. Thank you.
Thank you, CEO, and thank you, Chair and committee members, for affording the National Credit Regulator the opportunity to brief you on these issues. The issue of the, maybe first of all, let me say the acronym VDMS stands for Voluntary Debt Mediation Solution. This is a project that was initiated, voluntary debt mediation. This is a project that was initiated by an industry association called the National Debt Mediation Association, which is funded by credit providers, including the Banking Association. So the major banking is from the Banking Association. At the initial stages, the Banking Association and the NDMA, they approached the DTI and the SCR that they want to introduce this mechanism. However, they did not present any concept documents. So the NCR and the DTI informed them that we need to see the concept documents so that we can assess the document and see if there are no contraventions of the National Credit Act. To our surprise, they've never given us a concept document. And they communicated to us that they are going to implement this mechanism in July. And at that point, we informed them that they must put the implementation of the mechanism on hold because we wanted to assess its legality. They still insisted that they want to go ahead. And we conducted an investigation, and I'm just going to run through some of the issues that we discovered. First of all, when we assessed this mechanism, we were satisfied that it is going to be a parallel debt cancelling mechanism that is not regulated by the Act. And they were going to make use of our debt cancellers as debt mediators in the project. And these debt cancellers were going to assess the over-indebtedness of consumers, develop restructuring proposals. And these proposals were not going to be presented to the Magistrate Court and the National Consumer Tribunal. They were also using the statutory forms that are prescribed for statutory debt cancelling in this mechanism. The credit providers, mostly the banks who were participating in this project, were also making payments to the debt cancellers who are participating in the project. You know, a bank, for example, will refer a consumer to a particular debt counselor who was selected for the project and pay them a fee. And our concern with that is that contracts have an obligation, a statutory obligation, not to receive any commission or fees from a credit provider. This is meant to regard their independence and objectivity, because when they assess the over indebtedness of the consumer, they must also determine whether there are credit agreements which are reckless. And if there are credit agreements that are reckless, then they can select empowered to recommend to a court or the tribunal for that agreement to be declared reckless. But if they are paid by a credit provider, this will incentivize the concealment of reckless lending. And obviously another angle will be this gave rise to a situation of conflict of interest because you cannot serve two masters at the same time. And we also found that in a mechanism, consumers who were under debt mediation were going to be listed to the credit bureaus. And this is not allowed by the Act. You can only list a consumer who is under debt review. And another concern that we had is the debt rearrangement proposals that were going to be made in the mechanism were not going to be presented to the tribunal or the magistrate's court. Now the issues there are, if there is no judicial oversight over the process, who is going to make sure that the interest rates are calculated correctly? What is going to happen to reckless credit? Is it going to be swept under the carpet? So I think overall our main concern was this is a parallel debt cancelling process and we can't allow it to continue. Thank you.
That's really clarified that one. Not that we're happy. Thank you. If you just switch your mic off, thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. As we speak in terms of the VDMS, we've been assured by the CEO of the banks that, you know, at least most of the banks, that they have stopped this pilot and that they will support the statutory debt cancelling mechanism. The question around, you know, the fact that credit providers have been operating for a while now and there hasn't been any, you know, consideration to increase the interest that they can charge and the service fees. We did conduct a research called Cost of and Access to Finance, which looked at all of that. And the suggestion was that perhaps at the NCR we need to look at increasing not the interest rate, but the fees that credit providers can charge. We feel that the NCR at this point in time, although this is still under discussion, that it's a long time to even start introducing that when people are over indebted. And therefore, I don't think it would be responsible, you know, of us to suggest that, you know, fee and interest that can charge should be increased. Yes, and the link, the, you know, in respect of the, you know, Marikana episode, the link in terms of debt, you know, or loans owned by minors, the strikes that are currently happening, and unsecured personal loans. As the NCR, we don't have factual evidence to link the three. We are, you know, hoping the commission of inquiry that has been established, you know, can look into those matters because, you know, other, some of those issues really clearly don't fall in, you know, within our mandate. But we'll continue to monitor, you know, unsecured credit and any other, you know, loans that are extended to consumers. We have completed the study on unsecured credit. We did present the findings in the last meeting session that we had with Parliament. We are working on concrete, you know, recommendations, and we will, you know, keep the committee, you know, posted on what we are doing in that space. My team, I don't know if there's anything that I've left out that you want to.
Chair, with your permission, can I touch on the time limit attachment orders? They are currently regulated by the Magistrates Court Act and they are not covered in the National Credit Act. What the Act does is it outlaws the signing of blank documents, including them, at the time when the credit agreement is concluded. So if there is evidence that this order was given to a consumer at the time when they concluded a credit agreement, that will be a contravention of the National Credit Act.
As you say, the National Credit Regulator is looking into that, I mean, the DDG itself underline that point, that you're busy identifying these areas. And thank you very much so far. Over back to our committee here, we have Honourable Hill Lewis, followed by Honourable Hong.
Thank you very much, Chair. You recall last time the NCR was here, I asked whether there was any information on the number of garnishee orders issued in South African courts. You see, I think, I just want to ask whether you've managed to find any such information. I think if we saw a massive increase in garnishee orders, emolument attachments issued, that would be very definite and concrete evidence of a big problem. I'd really be interested to see that. I tried very hard to get that from the Department of Justice and all that, but it seems difficult. And you, through your channels, may be able to get that. You may have it already. Then I want to get into the details of the maximum interest rate chargeable. Currently, if I remember correctly, the formula for calculating the maximum interest rate chargeable is the repurchase rate times 2.5 plus 10. Is that correct? Do I remember correctly?
Sorry, Chair. It depends on the print product because they're different.
I mean for this one. Now, I just want to, two points on that. Firstly, because I wasn't here when we did the National Credit Act, what is the rationale behind having that 2.5 multiplier? Because the effect is that for every 1% increase in the repurchase rate, the repo rate, there's a 2.5% increase in the maximum chargeable interest rate, which has a bizarre perverse incentive that when the interest rate goes up, even though most banks stop lending, unsecured lenders, it actually becomes enormously more profitable for them to lend as the interest rate goes up. So I want to know, what is the thinking behind the 2.5 multiplier? Because it has, as far as I can see, a deleterious effect on consumers. We're at the bottom of the interest rate cycle now. In the next few years, we might see a 3 or 4% increase in the interest rate, which would be a 12% increase in the maximum chargeable rate to consumers, which would be, frankly, a disaster. So if you can enlighten me on that, and then possibly would you, I mean, I don't understand why we have to have a multiplier at all. Why can't we just say repo rate plus X, and we can talk about what X is? So there's no multiplier effect. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to alert the committee. We did receive the very, very, one of our best pieces of research we've had in this area. And on page 5 in particular, it relates under point 5 and on page 5, international best practice in this particular regard. And, yes, I thought I should just mention that. But the thing is, yes, on the one hand, while we accept that the one in Australia is higher, you know, than ourselves, nevertheless, that doesn't mean to say that's where we should be heading. And on top of this, it clearly states a credit contract that is covered by the code and exceeds the 48% limit is not enforceable and must not be entered into by the credit provider, etc. But I think what we do, I'm sure the department itself has recognized, and the division, that the cap is only on that interest rate itself, and that, you know, you don't require that the fees, etc., are included. And it's that kind of thing. When in going through the Act, because when we came in, the Act was here in this term, and we've said from the beginning, before we even reached this point, we were unhappy, and that's why we asked you to come and share with us, you know, your own overview and analysis of things. And all that seems to have happened is that it does seem, I hate to say it, I think this is on one of the few areas where the journalists may have been conservative in their articles, etc., where it does seem as if it could get out of hand. Because there doesn't appear, there was a question asked here, because there doesn't appear to be any mechanism somehow that prevents you exceeding your borrowings.
obtaining of loans, which is why you actually have a negative in your earnings because of that. Now, we need some mechanism drafted or crafted that may look at that for us to consider, but let me not take over from Honourable Huang and Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you. I think, Chair, you covered me partly. It was just on my first question, that's one of my previous questions about the unsecured lending of the actual banks, and the similar idea that the Chair said, that there is no cap. But for the large corporates, the banks are at the moment that are going into the microfinance sector, they attract people by saying that if you come to me, you can get X amount. Call it, the normal microfinancer will say, come to me, you can get, example, 10,000 Rand, for example. Whereas the large financiers, they'll go and give the person an extra credit and say, if you come to me, you can get 20,000 Rand. And that's where the reckless lending is. It's mainly with the large corporates. So is there a mechanism or a way to actually calculate of the cap to say that it should be more standardized or some form of way or suggestions or something to actually stop that maximum amount? Because now it's each corporate has got, they do their own calculation on saying this person has affordability of how much, and it depends on their risk assessment of the consumer. So are you actually looking into that? Thank you.
Honourable McIntosh?
And it's a short question, and linking into the strikes. One of the interesting things to me is that a figure which the strikers or summer strikers are claiming the minimum wage is 15,000 Rand. Now, I just wondered, and that's my question, is do you think that because 15,000 Rand is a certain threshold in terms of the National Credit Act, that could be a factor in deciding to go to 15,000 so that they are therefore enabled to borrow with less hassle and at a lower interest rate, if they understand that?
I just think, Honourable McIntosh, you know, I seldom say, look, this was not in our mandate. I think the question you're asking does not really apply here. We need to get to the Labour Department, the unions, and someone else in that regard. So I do think that, wage, they haven't studied that, believe you me. That's the problem.
Madam Chair, let me put it otherwise. What is the 15,000 Rand in terms of the National Credit Act? I mean, what does that define? Is there a category below or above 15,000 Rand?
Thank you very much. Yes. Now I'll be over to the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'd like to answer that question first. In terms of the National Credit Act, the sky's the limit in terms of the amount of money that you can extend to a consumer. It's only limited when it comes to juristic patents because the Act is really meant to protect small businesses. So the 15,000 earlier on I spoke about 15,000, but that was only in terms of the level at which, the level of income that is targeted at, or where most of the unsecured credit goes towards. It does not, it's not about, the fact that the credit act is only limited to people who earn 50,000. So it really doesn't matter, in terms of the amount of money that you earn. The credit agreement covers every individual in this country. And the question around the 2.2, it's actually the 2.2 multiplier that is used in the formula to calculate interest rate. We would like to look into that. Can I have your permission, Chairperson, to look into that and respond in writing? Because we don't know how that was arrived at. And in terms of the cap, by the banks, the other question that was asked, can we also, we'd like to propose that we also look into that and, respond in writing to that question. Thank you.
There are a couple of them I think you've identified yourselves that it would be worthwhile just to put in writing. And as noted here as a suggestion by our own researcher, which you were already looking at, is to devise strategies that treat both the supply and the demand side in this regard of the credit market. And I see you have been attempting. But I think anything more that you can offer us, and what I'm concerned about, yes, Marikana may have got onto and did get onto the front pages, and therefore everyone is taking certain lessons out. But the reality of this is it prefaced, it preceded Marikana, etc. And that may well have taken this issue to the front page, if you like, because it was there. But I do think we ought to look at the country generally in this regard, so that we take preventative measures, we develop more sound legislation, having seen, and so often legislation is passed, adopted by Parliament even, and then it's only in the implementation of that legislation that we become more aware as to how effective it really is. So I think that what the committee are doing really, we took this up from last year, we had you here earlier this year, we are continuing this follow-up, because yes, you know, I'm glad to hear that the DDG has confirmed that this amendment to this legislation is very much on radar screen and is being pursued, as she indicated before. Am I correct, DDG and Tuli? And we are concerned. And what I would ask that the committee does, individual members, or as we're doing with co-ops just now, all members, all of us, study what was said here in the research report as well. It's actually a very sound report. What we've received here, the earlier report, and let's come forth here to the portfolio committee secretary, and will let me see it as well, and we may be able to then raise some of these other questions you haven't really put together just at the moment, and we'll send them off to you so that when we get this written response, it covers as much as possible. But you know, Dede and Tuli, I really would like to thank you and to offer the CEO a last opportunity for a comment before you conclude. Honourable Hill-Lewis?
The issue on the numbers of garnishee orders issued or emolument attachments.
I think that's also coming back, the actual number, you see, because you're getting a very specific, let's get that, they must, but it's not going to be here off the cuff, you see. So I'm just giving us them the opportunity to come back with secure numbers with integrity. Yes, over to you, CEO.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, we will come back in writing with regards to responses to the last questions that were asked. And I'd just like to say to the NCR that we'll continue to watch the space and we'll make sure that we keep, you know, both the DDG, you know, and the Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members in terms of what, you know, NCR is doing on the ground in implementing this important piece of legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, CEO Motsekhai. And if we can have any closing statements you wish to make, DDG.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think you will know that over the years the NCR has really done a very good job, and I think you'll notice that they put good systems to monitor the market. We get regular statistics from the NCR which are giving us a sense of where they are. So I think what they have been doing right now is to now focus on their enforcement strategy to try now and deal with those unscrupulous credit providers. I think that's the area, because they have been focusing on compliance and assisting the market to comply. I think some of the market players take advantage of it because they were not enforcing but trying to help them to do that. So they've enhanced that, which is why they've adopted an enforcement strategy. And I think it's really up to us as well to really support their effort and also ensure that they've got sufficient resources, because investigations can be very expensive. I think we are aware of that, and especially in the space that they operate in. But I just want to say that the spirit with which the voluntary debt mediation solution was presented to us was a good spirit. I think as a regulator and ourselves as a department, it's always good for us when the industry says we have a solution to help, because one of the challenges that we had over the years was that the credit providers were not cooperative, especially around the debt cancelling issue, so which was making it difficult for this part of the legislation to be implemented effectively. So they came to us proposing that they would like to bring a solution that as the industry would like to have every industry player have a buy-in into, and they present that to us. Like, but as the company secretary alluded to, we did not get that proposal because we said to them, we'd like to scrutinize it first before we can say, okay, we think that that's something that can work. So they then went on to want to implement something that has not been brought to the regulator to look at whether it's okay or not. But I think we continue to welcome such initiatives from the industry, but as long as the industry works with the regulator and doesn't undermine the mandate of the regulator, I think it is an initiative that is welcome. So we look forward to them maybe perhaps revising some of these proposals that they have to ensure that they are in line with the act, and then so they can actually provide that kind of solution to the consumer. And so just also to just allude to the issue around marijuana. The issue about marijuana as an example, really, it's just an indication that if in one space you can identify so many violations, then how many more in this country when it's this big? And that was point in one mind. So you start getting worried as a regulator in terms of the extent of the concerns that you can pick up in this area. But yeah, I think over and above, we just want to say that we do have confidence that the regulator is going to deal with these issues, and we are confident they are monitoring the market and they'll be able to pick up some of these issues, and they've enhanced their proactive investigations, and we welcome that. And I just want to thank the committee again for allowing us the space to engage with yourself. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you, GDG, and Thule, and the team here from ACR. And of course, if you have anything in writing by 7th of November, that would be quite constructive. And what remains outstanding, you can let us have afterwards. But, you know, the sort of afternoon of the 6th of November, it could be helpful to have whatever there is, and then just let us know what will still be coming through to us. Okay. So, members, I think that's as far as we will go today. I know we thought we may do some minutes. I know we all have a lot of other priorities as well to deal with, so we will deal with the minutes on another day if that's all right with members in this regard. So thank you to the DTI and the MCR, and just noting, Mr. Herman, that our next meeting is on
Wednesday.
Right. It is the date? The 31st at 9 o'clock. Please, members, let's be here, and thank you for being here on time this morning. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.